This is a podcast from BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Welcome to Beyond the Ballot Box with me, Darshan Johan. On the 1st of April, there was a deadly strike by Israel on the Iranian consulate in Damascus, Syria. Iranian military commander Major General Mohammad Reza Zahidi was killed in the attack, along with six other Iranian nationals, including another general and at least six Syrian citizens. In retaliation, on April 13, Iran launched hundreds of drones and missiles at Israel in what they called Operation True Promise. But what lies at the heart of this conflict, and how will it impact the Middle East region as a whole? Joining me on the show today to discuss this is Dr. Asar Raad. She's a scholar of Middle East history. She works on research and writing related to US foreign policy issues, the Middle East, and contemporary Iran. She's also the author of The State of Resistance: Politics, Culture, and Identity in Modern Iran. This conversation is also available as a podcast. You can look up Beyond the Ballot Box on the BFM app, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from. Asal, welcome to the show. How are you today?
I'm good, thank you. Thank you for having me.
So, as mentioned in the introduction, on the 1st of April, there was a deadly Israeli strike on the Iranian consulate in Syria. What exactly happened? Could you contextualize this for us?
You have, for some time, for many years, this shadow war between Israel and Iran. For instance, if you look at Israeli assassinations on Iranian commanders, as well as nuclear scientists, right? Civilians, in the sense that they are scientists inside of the country, that goes back to more than a decade ago, from 2010. And so this is not totally unprecedented, but what we saw in the last 2 weeks is a push of that shadow war into the open. First, Israel's attack on Iran's consulate in Damascus was unprecedented in the sense that Israel took the attack to an actual embassy complex, which is quite different. Iran's response to that attack, which we saw over the weekend, is also unprecedented because it's the first time you've seen an attack on Israeli soil from Iranian soil. And so that's why we're sort of in the situation that seems very different than what we've seen in years past. Now, the other context to keep in mind on what happens on April 1st, why Israel carries out this attack, is the context of the war on Gaza, right? We cannot understand the region right now. We cannot contextualize the region or Israel's actions, especially within the region, without understanding that it has been in this six-month war that it claims is against Hamas, but has actually killed thousands upon thousands of Palestinian civilians, is starving a wide number of that civilian population, and has displaced more than 85-90% internally of that entire population. So when you look at it within this context, where there's growing international pressure on Israel to stop this campaign, to impose a ceasefire, that is the context that is really important to understanding why this attack happens. Because in terms of the analysis, on one hand, you think, well, this is part of the continued sort of tit-for-tat shadow war that's been between these two states. But it's also a way for Israel to expand this war outside of only Gaza and to stay in this sort of state of conflict, which to a certain extent benefits specifically Netanyahu, who wants to, you know, continue and expand the war, maintain his hold on power, especially because domestically in Israel, he's not necessarily a particularly popular political figure. And he wants to avoid jail time because this is someone who's also been indicted on several charges within Israel's own legal system. So those are the sort of complicated layers that help us understand why this attack takes place, why we see the Iranian response. And to understand the Iranian response, we have to understand that there's this sort of balancing act you see where Iran feels, because of its own domestic pressure, that it has to take out some kind of action, some kind of response, because of the nature of the attack that it endured by Israel. But also it wants to avoid a larger conflict. So you see that Iran had given a 72-hour notice to officials in Jordan, in Iraq, as well as in Turkey. These are all, you know, U.S. partners and allies in the region, so that everybody would know this is what's happening. It telegraphed its actions. And that's in part why Israel, especially the US, was able to intercept basically 99% of all of the drones and missiles that were fired. So it avoids damage, it avoids casualties. And on the Iranian side, this is a done response, right? With the matter can be concluded. But now it's really the ball is in Israel's court to see if it wants to take another escalatory step.
What is the relationship between Iran and Israel? Because on the one hand, as you indicated, there's been a shadow war between Iran and Israel for some time now. On top of that, tensions between Iran and Israel has definitely escalated since Israel began their most recent bombardment and ethnic cleansing of Gaza in October 2023. This month, Israel attacked the Iranian consulate in Syria. Iran retaliated. But what's interesting is that Iran then released a statement with carefully selected words, something to the effect of this was a specific response to Israel's attack on our consulate, and we now consider that chapter closed. What is that? What does this mean?
If you take a step back for a second, well, you know, it's sort of common knowledge that there's this rhetorical enmity between Israel and Iran. And the assumption is, well, that's just the case since the 1979 revolution in Iran and the existence of the Islamic Republic. The reality is a little bit different. In the 1980s, for instance, when Iran and Iraq were at war after the Iraqi invasion of Iran in 1980, when the US was secretly selling weapons to Iran in the Iran-Contra affair, it was actually Israel that was facilitating those sales. Right. So despite this rhetoric that you hear from the Islamic Republic, when there was practical political matters or national security interests, they would deal with Israel. And so this special sort of shift that you see happens more in the 90s in the post kind of peace process era, when in the early 1990s, there's the Madrid conference that's the beginning of the sort of peace process or what's called the peace process between Israel and the Palestinians. Iran is left out of that particular conference. And that's the idea that for basically every U.S. administration, except for the Obama administration, has tried to isolate Iran by creating a regional architecture where everyone is against Iran. And this has failed for decades, obviously, right? And we saw the failure of that, for instance, with the detente between Saudi Arabia and Iran last year, last March, right? Despite the fact that these two states are rivals, there's a realization that Iran exists, you know, right. Whatever, however much other powers try to isolate it, it's still one of the significant powers within the region. It's one of the largest states, one of the largest populations. And so the detente that you see with Saudi Arabia and Iran is sort of an acknowledgement of that fact. It's not necessarily to say, hey, let's be friends. It's more to understand if we're going to coexist in this region, it's going to be better if we can cooperate and avoid larger conflicts, because that's to everyone's detriment. And that's the logic that sort of informs the way that these detentes or these more peaceful coexistence initiatives have gone, especially in recent years. Now, on the Israeli front, you've seen in the last several decades a movement towards the right, more right-wing ultranationalism in Israel. The quintessential figure of that movement to the right has been Benjamin Netanyahu, who has been a central figure of Israeli politics since the 1990s. And who has boasted publicly about how happy he is that he's been responsible for preventing a Palestinian state, which was the entire point of the peace process that started in the early 90s. So you have specific figures who are also, you know, very intentionally creating the kind of instability that we're seeing. Netanyahu has done this by boasting about preventing a Palestinian state. He also boasts about sabotaging and undermining the Iran nuclear deal that created detente between the United States and Iran. This is in 2015, right? So it was under the Trump administration in 2018, pushed again by Netanyahu, that the U.S. decided to pull out of that agreement. All of these agreements, these international agreements, as well as these diplomatic achievements, have been meant to create more cooperation in the region under a regional security architecture that includes Iran rather than tries to isolate it. And that's been undermined by Israel over and over again. Now, the question is why? Why, for instance, if Israel says, which is this is the Israeli position that Iran is an existential threat to Israel, and therefore an Iranian nuclear weapon would be an existential threat to Israel, then why would Israel undermine the very deal that would prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon? Because as long as Iran is the sort of boogeyman, as long as Iran poses what Israel will call an existential threat to its existence, then the issue of Palestinian liberation and statehood is always set aside, especially in the West, right? Western powers like the United States will essentially allow Israel to do anything it wants, continue to arm and give military aid to Israel under the pretense that Israel is under constant threat. Now, it's the perception of threat that we have to question, because how much threat is Israel actually under when it can carry out what is plausibly a genocide in Gaza with no accountability, right? Besides a discourse of accountability, there's no practical accountability, right? Israel has not lost military aid. It's not losing weapons from the United States, which provides Israel with the most weapons. There are no sanctions against Israel. There's no threats of action against Israel, despite its laundry list of violations under international law. So that's sort of the dynamic to understand when you're navigating this space and why we are where we are right now.
So there's a lot to unpack there, but I want to go back to some of the things you brought up in the first question, right? Where you mentioned that what happened, the attack on the consulate, the embassy, is incredibly unprecedented. What is so significant about attacking a consulate in another sovereign nation?
Well, it violates a lot of things, right? It violates the sovereignty of not one, but at least two nations. It violates the sovereignty of Syria as a nation state, as well as Iran, because embassy soil is often understood as being, you know, an extension of that nation state itself. So you have the violations of sovereignty. You have the violations of diplomatic norms. Right? Embassies are supposed to be protected. They're supposed to we understand this, we saw ironically days after the bombing of the Iranian consulate in Syria, we saw Ecuadorian authorities raid a Mexican embassy in Ecuador. Now, the US was very fast to condemn that action, because, and used the exact language that I'm using right now, right? Diplomatic norms. And yet, the US hasn't yet to condemn Israel's action against the Iranian consulate, right? So you see these double standards of the way that we look at things, but we understand the importance of protecting embassies, consulate offices and complexes, because that's how diplomacy works. I mean, we trust the idea that if you have these diplomatic missions in other countries, that your personnel, that everybody will be safe in those locations. And so it breaks with what have been for a long time accepted norms within the international community, things that the US itself has championed over and over again, and yet is not applying to the case of Israel.
Asal, I want to go back to Gaza, October the 7th, and the events that have unfolded since then. According to reports, Iran-backed military group Hezbollah and the Israeli military have been trading attacks across the Lebanon-Israel border since the 8th of October 2023, which is a day after Palestinian resistance forces led by Hamas broke through the Israeli siege of Gaza. I think first things first, what's Hezbollah and how does the events of the latest chapter in the, 70-year oppression of the Palestinian people by Israel, how does the latest chapter, the events of 7th of October, tie into the larger regional conflicts we are witnessing today?
To understand Hezbollah, oftentimes Hezbollah is linked with the Islamic Republic of Iran as if it's entirely tied to the Islamic Republic.
Right.
But the roots of Hezbollah predate the Islamic Republic, right? So you have the revolution in 1979. But before that, you had Shia groups like Amal in southern Lebanon that were trying to essentially organize the Shia population, which was is the largest plurality of religious groups in Lebanon, and one of the most disenfranchised at the time. And so when you see Hezbollah emerge in the early 1980s, and this is after the revolution in Iran, it's formed from those roots, right? So that's what I mean by I say the roots predate the existence of the Islamic Republic. But of course, the Islamic Republic has a significant role in helping create Hezbollah. And there are ties historically between Shias in Iran and in Lebanon that go back centuries. So there's other historical ties between them. But Hezbollah really is founded as a group to fight back against the occupation of southern Lebanon by Israel in the early 80s, right? This is part of the context that's so important to understand is Israel was occupying southern Lebanon. And it is Hezbollah that helped to protect southern Lebanon and actually repel Israeli forces eventually which withdrew from Lebanon, I believe it was in like the year 2000. So it was like you have all of these years of Israel trying to occupy, not only does it occupy Palestinian territories, the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza, it also occupies the Golan Heights, which is part of Syria. It also, for a long time, occupied southern Lebanon. So you have Israeli forces really trying to occupy different areas within the region. And so if you want to understand how these conflicts come about, a lot of it is coming about through these occupations. You know, what should be the recognized borders of Israel? What should be the recognized borders of a Palestinian state? And how this creates a lot of instability within the region as you have this issue that is unresolved and has been unresolved for so many decades. So, you know, it's very, from the Western perspective, the entire narrative is built around this idea that Israel has the right to exist, and there's no real conversation about, but do Palestinians also have the right to exist?
Right.
Should there be a Palestinian state? Do Palestinians have the right to self-defense? Do Palestinians have the right to self-determination? And while you have heard multiple U.S. administrations say, well, yes, the Palestinians have, you know, the right to self-determination, the path to self-determination has constantly been thwarted. And all we've seen through these decades is more and more land being seized and annexed by Israel, and more movement towards a really extremist ideology, even within the United States, to support that, which is why, you know, under the Trump administration, you actually had, which was unprecedented, a U.S. administration that recognized settlements in the West Bank as belonging to Israel, as that land belonging to Israel, which is absolutely flies in the face of international law and international precedent, as well as U.S. precedent for administration after administration. Under the Biden admin, we've seen more continuity than one would hope with their predecessors. It is only maybe a few weeks ago, maybe within the last month or two, that the Biden admin finally came out and said that it's not continuing with the Trump admin's decision to say that land in the West Bank belongs to Israel, which is just what's accorded under international law.
Right.
So when you look at the conflict and how it involves other states in the region, it's because of the expansion of that occupation that goes beyond the borders of Israel and Palestine and actually affects other states around them as well.
Let's go for a very quick break. On the show with me today is Dr. Asal Rad. She's a scholar of Middle East history. We'll continue this conversation after these messages. Keep it here on Beyond the Ballot Box, BFM 89.9.
Beyond Frivolous Matters, BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Welcome back to Beyond the Ballot Box. I'm Dashrin Johan, and on the show with me today is Dr. Asal Rad. She's scholar of Middle East history, and she's helping me make sense of the conflict relationship between Iran and Israel. As always, this conversation is also available as a podcast. You can look up Beyond the Ballot Box on the BFM app, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from. So, how does the U.S. and Western allies fit into this picture? What role does the U.S. empire play in escalating or de-escalating tensions between Iran and Israel?
Unfortunately, it usually plays a role of escalating those tensions, right? Because, on one hand, there was what I brought up earlier about the peace process and how Iran was intentionally by the U.S. left out of that process. The U.S. has been integral in the attempt to isolate Iran in the region and internationally. In the last 45 years, the one administration that took a different approach, that understood Iran, like I said, is just a part of the region, whether or not we like it, that is the reality on the ground, was the Obama admin, right? And that's why, and the conclusion of that different approach was the Iran nuclear deal. Now, opponents of diplomacy with Iran, Iran hawks in the U.S., made the claims back in 2014, 2013, and 15, saying, well, Iran would never negotiate with the U.S., Iran could not be trusted, and Iran would never abide by a deal. We have a unique situation where we actually have now a history that denies all of that as being true, because in fact, Iran did negotiate with the U.S., they did come to an agreement, and Iran did abide by that very deal, as was certified by the Obama administration and the Trump administration, right? The Trump admin certified the deal multiple times because Iran was abiding by it. So when a different approach was taken by a U.S. administration, you actually saw real benefits, a real advantage to that. And that was the nuclear deal. But unfortunately, we had the Trump admin come in and sort of go back to the traditional way of thinking, which was just isolate Iran. And we've seen Biden do the same thing in that situation. So one of the ways I think that's really important to think about this history is, if you want to have peace in the region, and people always ask about this, how can you have peace in the Middle East? Well, it starts, if you're Israel, it starts with equality and freedom for Palestinians. The answer is not decades of occupation, is not apartheid, is not siege and blockades, it's not flattening Gaza every few years. It's giving the rights that are enshrined within international law and deserving of all peoples to have, including Palestinians, without resolving that issue. Normalization with Arab states, whatever we do with Iran, none of these policies will have an effect until that central issue is resolved. And that's where the U.S. has failed the most. The U.S. has failed because it has not been an honest or fair broker in negotiating peace between Palestinians and Israelis. And it has allowed Israel essentially to violate international law at every turn with no accountability. And that's part of what has facilitated this ultra-nationalist movement to Israel, which has culminated in the most extreme form of crimes against humanity that we are seeing today in Gaza.
What do you make of the West's condemnation of Iran's actions, considering how they report on anything surrounding Israel, right? Whether you look, it's the ongoing genocide in Gaza, or plausible genocide, as the International Court of Justice has put it, or whether it's the strike on the Iranian consulate. There seems to be a double standard in the way they report. How do you see that? And how does the portrayal of Iran as the sort of sole aggressor and Israel as a victim in Western mainstream media narratives, how does this impact public opinion?
Oh, it's vital to shaping public opinion, right? Because look, and if you just look at it from a rational, reasonable perspective, if you were to take the names of the states or the people or anything out of it, there would be no situation that you would logically accept the idea that one actor is always correct, never does anything wrong 100% of the time, and the other actor is always incorrect, always the one doing something wrong 100% of the time, right? That just doesn't resonate logically in anyone's mind. And what's happened is, I mean, we talk about double standards and hypocrisy. I mean, the West has been... double standards and hypocrisy are not new to the Western world. What justified genocide, colonization, imperialism, slavery for centuries was based on a double standard of how the Western world saw itself vis-a-vis the rest of the world, right? So this is nothing new. It's just that we live in our contemporary societies, we live with these ideas that are so wonderful to hear, right? International law, self-determination, sovereignty, but they've never really been applied fairly across the board. And that's why I think the case of Palestine is so critical to understand, is that this was a settler colony that was created in the wake of World War II and the establishment of an international system which said you're not allowed to do that, right? After the establishment of international law that said borders must be protected, sovereignty and self-determination are vital to global peace and to avoid the scourge of war. That's what the United Nations was founded on. That's when you have the creation of the State of Israel in the wake of that. And so I think it's such an important issue to understand, and understanding U.S. hypocrisy, Western hypocrisy behind that. But what we've seen in the last 6 months is that the hypocrisy is so brazen. It's so in your face that even for people who have not followed these issues, might not be familiar with the history, they see it now, right? If you had studied the region, if you had studied its history, you'd be familiar with Orientalism and colonialism. You would already know that these hypocrisies have always existed. But if you never knew those things, now you're seeing it in such an obvious way that it's sort of taken the blinders off. And the way that the Western narrative has shaped the way that people think, you can see that in polling, right? So there was a poll recently in the US that said half of Americans don't know if more Palestinians or Israelis have died in the recent conflict. That's wild.
Right.
I mean, because the numbers are astronomically different. So how that factual information is lost on half of a population is not the fault of the population. It's the fault of the institutions that are meant to inform that population, and shows you how misleading the way that information is presented is, that people don't know the basic facts on the ground. I'll give you another example of another poll. This was one carried out by Brookings Institute about 2 or 3 years ago, that showed more Americans falsely believe that Iran possesses nuclear weapons than believe that Israel possesses nuclear weapons, when in fact Israel actually does.
That's why. That is out of this. Yeah.
So how do you get such a misinformed public? It's the information they're being given. It's the rhetoric that's being used, because these are facts on the ground. You know, you could very easily find these facts if you're searching for them. They're indisputed facts. And yet the public perception is the opposite, because Israel is always portrayed as a victim. Now, Iran is a nation state. It has a military. It has a strong population. But the fact that Israel is displayed as a victim vis-a-vis the population it occupies, Palestinians, that is the part that I think is really wild to imagine how it's even possible. How can you fathom that Israel is the victim when Israel is the occupying power? How is that possible? And the simplest way of understanding that right now in the last 6 months, you heard Israeli defense minister in October say, we're going to cut off food, water, and electricity. Why does Israel have the power to do that? Can Canada cut off the food, water, and electricity to the United States? Of course not, because they control those resources. Israel controls those resources in Gaza, and that's why they could cut it off. And we saw the ramifications of that decision, which is the starvation of Palestinians in Gaza. So it's the fact that Israel can be victimized to such an extent that it is even the victim right now of a plausible genocide it is carrying out against another population, really shows you the depth of that narrative and how asymmetric it is and how it presents the truth.
Earlier you mentioned, you know, the two approaches of the American government, whether it's just isolation or the slightly more progressive approach, which is just recognize that Iran exists, whether you like it or not, and have some sort of diplomacy with them, discussions and so on and so forth. But this seems to be a contentious issue, even among the Iranian left. From my vantage point, it feels like, you know, some people prefer the isolation approach because they are fervently against the theocratic regime of Iran. So I'm guessing, how should regular working class people who are internationalists, you know, in their views, how should they make sense of this? Because on the one hand, Israel is part of the Western imperial regime. It is a genocidal state. On the other hand, people will point to how, you know, leftist progressives in Iran are protesting against the Iranian Islamist regime. The Women Life Freedom Movement, for example, comes to mind. How should we make sense of all of this?
I think you make sense of it by treating treating everything within the confines of international law, right? A set of standards. If we say that Iran has to follow a set of standards, which it should, that standard has to be applied to everyone, and that includes Israel. One of the issues with sort of tearing up international law in the way that the US and Israel have done over the last 6 months is when you undermine the entire system, then no one can be held accountable under it. And that's really been the question. The question is not, it's not to reverse the rule, right? It's not to say hold Israel accountable, but not Iran. It's hold both of them accountable. But the reality on the ground is it's not Israel that's been held accountable, right? Iran, up until 2 years ago, was the most sanctioned country in the world. That means there's significant punitive measures on Iran. It's been subject to international sanctions, embargoes. The United States has threatened Iran with more and more sanctions. Israel has threatened Iran with attacks, essentially. Iran does not gets $0 in military aid from the United States. Iran gets no weapons from the United States. So the point is, why aren't we treating them the same? That's the issue. So that's the central thing, right? The central thing is within the international system, everyone should be treated the same, and they have not been treated the same. So when the argument is made that Israel should be treated not as if it's above the law, it's not to say that Iran now should be the one that's treated as if it is, right? They should be treated equally. So there's that point. On top of that, I do think it's really interesting sometimes because a lot of the sort of hawkish Iran voices in the US that will tell you things like, we should support social movements within the country that are against the Islamic Republic, against the governing powers. Absolutely. I would agree, right? We should always be supporting people's rights, human rights. Again, a standard across the board. Women in Iran should have equal rights. Women everywhere should have equal rights. What's ironic, though, is how many of those hawkish voices didn't care about Iranian voices when they wanted a nuclear deal, when they voted, right? When 70% of the population went out to the polls to vote in 2017 to reelect Rouhani because they wanted a nuclear deal and a detente, most importantly, with the United States. When Iranians celebrated that deal, those same people didn't care about Iranian agency then. Right? Those are still Iranians. That's what they wanted at that time. Now, the situation on the ground has changed in part because of the decisions of the United States, obviously in part because of the decisions of the leadership in Iran as well. Both parties are responsible for their own agency and actions. So the situation on the ground has changed, and we have to acknowledge that change as well. I just think there has to be consistency with the way that we talk about Iranian agency. Iranians don't only have agency when they do what you want them to do. They have agency when they do what you don't want as well. They always have agency. They have agency when they boycott elections. They have agency when they vote in elections, right? So this is the thing I think that I find a little bit frustrating in the way that it's talked about. But certainly we should be supporting labor movements in Iran, workers' movements in Iran, human rights, women's rights. All of these things should be supported. But you can do that while simultaneously understanding that Israel's actions are still illegal under international law.
Do you think sometimes there's a tendency to conflate, or perhaps, you know, because, you know, the media manufactures consent in a certain way, you know, that people's opinions are slightly skewed, even the well-intended people who may not realize it, right? So, for example, when you know, after October the 7th, when people were starting to realize about what's going on, although this has been going on for decades. And, you know, many people were saying that, you know, if you care about the rights of sexual minorities, if you care about women's rights and so on and democracy, then why would you support Palestine, right? But there is a question of, if you care about the rights of sexual minorities, wouldn't you want sexual minorities to not get bombed in the first place? I think shouldn't that be the starting point? But people, you tend to see, like, sometimes people tend to conflate these things. For example, just within the Iranian diaspora, for example, when I just try to read up on some conversations, there is this tendency sometimes to be that we dislike the theocratic Islamist regime, which I think is perfectly understandable, but then that sometimes leads to then we must then be pro-West automatically, or anything that the Iranian regime is embroiled in any conflict, we must be against Iran.
Absolutely, because the complexity, though, is not as complicated as we think, right? We're not advocating for governments, because if we're being honest, most of them are terrible. Most of them are terrible. We're advocating for people. And as long as you're advocating for people, then I think you can maintain some kind of consistency, right? So the idea that Iranians are against a theocratic system that suppresses them politically, socially, that they're suffering under economically, is 100% valid and correct. Anybody in their situation would feel the same. We have to also understand that there are a diversity of views within that country, just like there's a diversity of views within our country. Even if it represents a minority, that minority still exists. And there's a tendency to sort of paint an entire society with one brush. The idea of democracy is not that I protect your right to agree with me. It's I protect your right to disagree with me. That's the foundation of a democracy, right? If I'm just saying, hey, everyone who agrees with me should have the right to say what they want to say, that's not really democracy. That's just one group that you assume is the better group having the power and the freedom to do things versus the one that you see as an adversary. And so I think sometimes within these conversations, when you see that conflation, right? Well, what about this group and what about this group? It's like, well, no, we're talking about everyone. The entire point of liberation is a liberation for everyone. But you can't justify, I mean, it just sounds, when I say it out loud, it sounds insane. You cannot justify a genocide because you think, what about women's rights? Right. And there's also a lot of sort of misleading information. Right. So I've seen commentary about, for instance, like in Gaza, like women have to wear, look at women who are covered in Gaza. It's not imposed. Well, this is culturally for a lot of women. They're doing it.
Right.
They're choosing to do it. But we've seen many, many images of young Palestinian women in Gaza, reporters who are not donning a hijab, because that's not really the case. Right. So there's also just a lot of misleading information when you deal with the region as a whole. Iran is a country that has mandatory hijab, so you can talk about it there, but you can't apply that to the entire region, right? There's this idea that Islam as a whole is repressive, forgetting that 2 billion people adhere to this religion, right? So there's a lot of conflating in that sense. But I think if you continue to advocate for people and not governments, then we can get over that kind of inability to navigate that space, right? So if you're advocating for Palestinian people, that doesn't mean you're advocating for Hamas, right? If you're advocating for Iranian people, you're not advocating for the Islamic Republic. These are not the same thing. And one of the things I think specifically in the Palestinian case that I find the most frustrating, when Hamas is centered, right? When you compartmentalize things, right? When we talk about Gaza as if it's separate from the West Bank, from East Jerusalem, we don't understand that they're all Palestinians.
Right.
And this is not about just Gaza. This is about all Palestinian liberation. As Gaza is being bombarded, Palestinians are being killed in the West Bank. There's more land seizure. There's the expansion of settlements. That is simultaneously, these things are happening. And at the same time, when you center Hamas, you make it seem like that's the story of Palestinians, as if that's representative of this entire group of people, which it is. That nothing could be further from the truth. Palestinians have been occupied decades before Hamas even existed. The vast majority of the history of the Palestinian liberation movement is a secular nationalist movement. So I think sometimes when you see that kind of centering, it's done intentionally, because that's what shapes people's perceptions. If you say Hamas, people think, oh, that's the bad guy. And you associate it with all Palestinians. And you don't look at this as a much larger picture of what it is. When you talk about only Gaza, you forget that Gaza is connected, or should be connected, to the West Bank, to East Jerusalem, to the Palestinian diaspora. So, you know, that's my long way of saying, advocate for people, right? We absolutely advocate for every minority, for all rights, but you cannot advocate for any rights when everyone is being killed.
What would the ripple effect be if Iran and Israel actually go to war? How likely is that for that to happen today? Israel can bully Palestine because you are dealing with resistance fighters, militant groups, and so on and so forth. Palestinians do not have the backing of powerful nations. But Iran, they have a powerful military as well, probably equally as powerful as Israel. If an Israel and Iran go to war, what's going to be the ripple effect around the region?
I don't like to make predictions because, you know, it's not, it's a very unpredictable situation.
Right.
And the reason it's unpredictable is because we're basing our analysis on human decisions. And those decisions can change at any time, especially when you have these sort of volatile personalities and a volatile situation as tensions keep rising. And usually what leads to larger conflicts is a miscalculation, right? The idea, the very rarely do leaders calculate knowingly, hey, we're going to get into a 20-year war right now if we do this. That's not what they're thinking typically when they do it. And so it's a, or if we, you know, if we do this bombing, this will not lead to a war, but then it's a miscalculation. Actually, it does. And there's a lot of historical examples of things like that. But so it's hard to know, like, what will be the miscalculation that then leads to a larger war. What we can say is what would be problematic about it, right? If the U.S. decision to invade Iraq in 2003 is now universally and commonly understood as a major foreign policy blunder, right? A huge miscalculation that leads to decades of war, the rise of new terrorist groups, instability in the region. If we understand that, then we should know that a war with Iran would be significantly worse, because Iran of today, Iran in 2024, is not comparable to Iraq in 2003. Iran is a much larger country geographically. The population is much larger. It has a more layered and complicated military apparatus. It has groups that are aligned with it within the region that have, that don't always have the same interests. And when they do not act together. In fact, they act against each other when on opposite sides. For instance, Hamas and Iran are acted on opposite sides in Syria, right? And I say that because so often people say things like Iran backed, as if Iran is a puppet master. That is misleading, right? So that's not the case. But they do have these alliances within the region. And so that makes it much more formidable than the case of Iraq in 2003. That's why we should be avoiding this, right? That's why we should be thinking much more about how did we get here and how do we prevent this from happening? And that's, I think, the frustration as an American, at least, dealing with this administration, is nothing is being done to try and prevent it in reality. Right, there's the idea, they say they're trying to prevent it. But for instance, after the attack on the Iranian consulate, the Iranian UN mission said publicly, no retaliation would be necessary if the UN would condemn Israel's action. The US opposed this condemnation, right? There was a draft statement for the UN Security Council. The US opposed any condemnation of Israel. The US was asked, U.S. officials were asked in a press briefing with the State Department, well, essentially, like, why not just condemn this?
Right.
The U.S. refuses to do so, right? So what if we had just done that? What if the U.S. had just condemned this? That would have been a verbal thing. It didn't require any punitive measures on Israel. Everything could have maintained the way that it was. But at least it would show on a global stage that Israel is condemned for an action against Iran. But the refusal to do so is what led to Iran's reaction. Let's go further back than that. What if the US had not vetoed multiple ceasefire resolutions and actually checked Israel's war on Gaza, stopped it months ago? How many thousands of lives could have been saved, and we would have stopped any kind of escalating conflict? What if when the UN finally passed a ceasefire resolution, because the US abstained, they didn't undermine it by calling it non-binding, right? So there's repeated things that the US has done, that this administration has done, to create the situation that we are in, right? So it's very difficult to sort of accept the idea that the Biden admin is trying to avoid a conflict when it's done everything in its power to create the conditions for that conflict. Saying it is not enough. There needs to be action that matches it. And that's what we have yet to see.
So before we wrap this conversation up, just some closing thoughts from you. Where do we go from here, or where should we go from here to de-escalate tensions between Israel and Iran and move towards something more positive, something more, diplomatic in nature?
First place we start is by at least rhetorically, at least within our language, just saying, hey, Israel also has to follow these rules. You are not immune to international law. Because we've said that about Iran, we've said that about Russia, we've said that about every other country. We say it, we match it as an international community, right? We match it with UN resolutions, with punitive measures, with embargoes, with sanctions, with all sorts of tools that are at our disposal to say, when a nation takes action that breaches international law, there should be consequences. We have to acknowledge that Israel is playing a role in this. It is not a perpetual victim. It is actively engaging in acts that have created tension and conflict. And it is actively currently engaging in a genocidal campaign in Gaza. That's where this starts. It starts by stopping what is happening in Gaza, by addressing the Palestinian issue once and for all, and by liberating Palestinians, by saying that all peoples have the right to self-determination. Both sides are freed in that sense. You often hear things about, what about the security of Israelis? And I agree. Israelis, like every other human being on the planet, should be able to live with security. But that security can only come through mutual security and mutual freedom, not the advantage of one group of people over another. And once we can acknowledge that and actually put in the steps to impose not oppression, but equality, those are the steps we have to take.
Dr. Asal, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
I've been speaking to Dr. Asal Raj. He's a scholar of Middle East history. And this has been Beyond the Ballot Box, BFM 89.9.
You have been listening to a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station. For more stories of the same kind, download the BFM app.